Full Committee of the House will come to order June 22, 2006. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're here today to receive testimony on best practices from experts in the field of information security and data breaches. We will also hear from the Department of Veterans Affairs General Counsel about the legal implications of the VA's information security breach and data loss. This hearing is part of a series that will help us determine how to to understand the scope of the problems so we can then proceed to help and assist in the correction of these concerns at the department. We are systematically examining key aspects of the security breach and reviewing the best practices and thinking in the realm of information security. Last week, we heard testimony from the VA Inspector General and from the Government Accounting Office that provided historical context. The context is sobering. Even as far back as 1997, the GAO had recommended, began to examine these problems, and then in 2002, they recommended the VA centralize its IT security management functions and establish an information security program. The VA's own Inspector General has gone on the record with a similar litany of warnings that have been largely, if not completely, ignored. The VA's Assistant Inspector General for Audit told us the IG has reported VA information security controls as a material weakness in its annual consolidated financial statements since fiscal year 1997 audit. VA's IG's Information Security Management Act audits have identified significant information security vulnerabilities since FY 2001. A reasonable person might ask what the VA is waiting for. The IG and GAO, our investigations have shown, are not alone in their support for centralized IT management. On June 8th, I held a roundtable discussion with information technology experts from business, including Goldman Sachs, EMC Corporation, Visa, Citigroup, TriWest, and American Bankers Association. At my invitation, attending was also the chairman of the Military Quality of Life and Veterans Affairs Appropriations Subcommittee, Jim Walsh. These experts offered candid appraisals of emphasized the importance of centralized information security management. None, from a good business sense, could endorse the VA's approach, the federated model, which still shows a significant degree of decentralization. One of the experts said, quote, "I see the federated approach as an excuse for lack of controls." As part of our approach, the Subcommittee on Disability Assistance and Memorial Affairs held a hearing on Tuesday on information security at the Veterans Benefit Administration. Yesterday, the Subcommittee on Health examined how the Veterans Health Administration maintains security and integrity of the electronic health records of patients. Both systems face challenges. We are aware of the problems of the Benefits Administration. The VAIG has testified at VHA, tens of thousands of VA's health records have been sent by unencrypted email and were made vulnerable to interception. Problems with control of access to data, password protection, and even a failure to terminate access for long-departed employees create the conditions for additional disasters. The more we learn about the awful results of decentralization, in contrast to the bright promises offered by some VA officials, the more we see that the system has no departmental standards. More important, the system, if you call it that, doesn't identify who is in charge of developing policy, implementing policy, or enforcing policy. It does not have to be this way. Today, experts from the academic world will also provide insights into the cutting-edge information security theories and concepts. The recent passing of management excerpt Professor Peter Drucker reminds us that not all expertise is to be found in the world of practice. We have much to learn from those who earn their pay strictly from the work in their minds. We will then turn to the Department's General Counsel, the Honorable Tim McLean, who will provide testimony regarding the legal implications of VA's data breach. I will also be interested in learning more about the legal review process for VA's Information Security Directive for the past 3 years. Also, I want to learn more about the adequacy of the VA's legal authorities to provide credit counseling and compensation to veterans affected by the loss of their personal information. Next week, completing this series of hearings, the full committee will receive testimony from former VA chief information officers. And finally, we will hear from the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Nicholson, and the department's senior leadership with an update on the progress being made at the department. So please be sure to note these important dates on your schedule. This weekend, we learned that a laptop stolen from a contractor working for the city of Washington, D.C., compromised sensitive information on thousands of city employees. While we are now seeing that data security has broad implications across the country and across government, we would like to see, is VA moving from worst disaster to best practice? We look forward to your testimony. I recognize the ranking member for any comment that he might have. Mr. Filner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, as we said last week, thank you for embarking on this series of oversight hearings. I don't think it's any accident that the VA announced finally of some proactive measures yesterday. And I think it's the calendar that you have outlined, that reporting will have to be done, that has sparked some activity. So I thank you for setting it up. I think this is the way that the Congress must proceed in terms of oversight. So thank you so much. As you pointed out, we have to figure out what happened, how it happened, what happened, how to prevent it, who was responsible, and, of course, what can be done about it in the future. As Chairman Booyer has pointed out on many occasions, we have heard that longstanding problems in cyber and information security went uncorrected at VA for unconscionably long times. We have heard testimony before this committee that the problem lies within the VA's culture of resistance to change, including being impervious to change in, of all arenas, information security. One written statement at a previous hearing even offered a rationale that the resistance of VA may be due to a desire to avoid accountability. Mr. Chairman, last week you and Dr. Snyder both noted apparent problems and conflict with VA General Counsel opinions in 2003 and 4. The net effect of these opinions, and we'll hear what the General Counsel says, was to create confusion at VA regarding aspects of enforcement authority for information security. How could this happen if the Federal Information Security Management Act of 2002 was created just to resolve these very problems? And we have seen evidence of difficulty of implementing change in the IT culture at VA. For you, Mr. Booyer, the most illustrative example of that resistance was Secretary Principe's failed directive to centralize control of IT under the Chief Information Officer. His was the right solution, but it never happened. And when the edicts of the Secretary and his team are ignored by the agency, it is time for the Secretary to clean house. In this case, I and a number of our colleagues would be pleased to help move that process along. All too often, we hear about policy changes at VA that are in the works, or we hear about half solutions and changes that are just around the corner. Problems were raised about the HR Links program, but substantive solutions were never implemented. HR Links was a good idea, but leadership was needed, and there was none. The result, about a third of a $1 billion loss to taxpayers. VetsNet will automate critical functions associated with the compensation and ratings awards if it is ever fully implemented. But I note that the future tense is always used to address hoped-for solutions to VetsNet for over a decade. The core FLS is another example of a major information technology failure in the multi-hundred-million-dollar loss range. And the root cause, I think, is evident, mismanagement at the top. It is not enough to move the entrenched culture inside the agency to conform to what is best for the entire agency and for veterans. That's why we're here. At a minimum, as is often suggested by the Inspector General, implementation of a robust and standardized policy would be helpful, and that has yet to happen. At our last full committee hearing, Mr. Michaud referred to a threat by an offshore-based subcontractor to post medical information about 30,000 veterans on the Internet. Yet when committee staff asked about the offshoring of medical transcription services in previous years, they were told that there was no evidence of such activity. The IG now seems to have found ample evidence in a report released last week. This indirection and indifference by the Veterans Administration regarding its protection of sensitive information must halt. We need to have straight shooting with Congress and with the American people. Finally, Mr. Speaker, a little early for that, huh? Mr. Bouyer.
I don't want that job.
The magnitude of the loss of the 26 million records, plus apparently hundreds of thousands of others, is breathtaking. Looks like we're moving in a proactive way, although we have yet to see what contractor will come out. I hope we don't give the contractor to Halliburton. And in fact, one of the companies that is here today, I think, has offered the public service of doing it for a very low, if any, cost to the taxpayers. So we must assure that any promises we make to fix the problem can actually be kept. We must set expectations for veterans that will come through and have the willpower to keep those problems. Let's keep the faith with our veterans. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Our first panel includes Dr. Eugene Spafford, PhD, who is professor of computer science and is executive director for the Center of Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security at Purdue University. Next, we have Mr. Bruce Brody, Vice President, Information Security for Input, and former Associate Deputy Assistant Secretary for Cyber and Information Security with U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And finally, we have Mike Cook, Vice President of ID Analytics. Dr. Spafford, I want to thank you for often the federal government has turned to you for your counsel. We did in the mid-1990s with DOD. You were assisting the Department of Air Force. You've helped out with the FBI. We've turned to your expertise with regard to NSA. And once again, we are now turning to you, and you don't hesitate. And so there's something inside that says, yes, I have knowledge, I have some expertise, and I'm willing to help my country. And you've been there, and you also have served on the President's advisory. I welcome all the members. How many of these do you have, or can you gain access to? You have about 50 or 70 of them out there? Are you only here by yourself? You have somebody with your staff? Will somebody go out there and give one of these to Tim McClain for me right now while he can flip through this? Tim, have you seen this before? It's very interesting. If you grab that box, I want to make sure everybody, all of my colleagues, have this. Look how it's titled, Cybersecurity, A Crisis of Prioritization. The President put these experts together. Dr. Spafford, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Bouyer and members of the committee. It is my pleasure to be here to attempt to help in this case. We're here because of a significant breach of security and privacy at the Veterans Administration. That incident has obviously exposed many people to an increased risk of identity theft, credit fraud, and other kinds of criminal activities. I'd like to point out, however, that it is more than a financial impact that is potentially there. In addition, some of our active duty personnel and veterans may find themselves denied security clearances or find their names added to the TSA's no-fly list because somebody else has misused their identity. And if you've ended up on the no-fly list and tried to get off, you know how difficult that is. They may also have to deal with criminal warrants or civil actions because others have committed crimes in their name. This problem is not unique to the Veterans Administration, however. A recent article in Computer World noted that since the start of 2005, there have been nearly 200 similar incidents resulting in significant disclosure of personal information, with nearly 90 of those incidents occurring since the beginning of this year. The total number of records disclosed by all of these incidents to date is 88 million. What is more, those are only the detected and reported incidents. The actual number is certainly much larger. For decades, professionals in the field of information security have been warning about the dangers of weak security, careless handling of data, lax enforcement of policies, and insufficient funding for both law enforcement and research. This is similar to what you've been hearing from the Inspector General of the Veterans Administration. Our warnings and cautions have largely been dismissed, however, as unfounded or too expensive to address. Unfortunately, we are now seeing the results of that lack of attention with incidents such as what happened at the VA. In addition, we have seen new levels of sophisticated computer viruses and spyware emerging, increasing cyber activity by organized crime around the world, and significant failures of security across a wide variety of public sector entities and government agencies. In the brief time that I have for my verbal remarks, I want to make special note of one particular failure present in this case that you have already identified. There is no centralized position that has all three of the components that are necessary to effectively manage information security: resources, accountability, and authority. There should be either the CIO or a CISO, a Chief Information Security Officer, who has adequate funding and trained personnel to carry out a comprehensive security plan. That office and the management above it must be held accountable for failures to satisfy necessary standards and to successfully pass audits. Last of all, that same office must have authority to make changes, shut down systems if necessary, and sanction employees for cause. There are other information security problems at the VA and elsewhere in the government, which were not directly involved in the May disclosure incident, but could prove problematic later. It is beyond the scope of this testimony to describe all of them. It's also beyond the scope of this testimony to summarize the magnitude of cyber threats currently facing our information infrastructure, including the Veterans Administration. There are a number of reports describing these threats, and I can summarize simply by saying that the situation is poor and getting worse. Regrettably, I believe the situation is going to get worse because the problems have been ignored and neglected for too long to be quickly remedied. As a member of academia, I wanted to say that we can offer few immediate solutions. Although we have several good programs at many colleges and universities across the United States, we are producing too small a number of students to meet the demand. Exacerbating this is a lack of resources. Outside of a few underfunded programs through the National Science Foundation that award competitive grants to faculty, and a few congressionally directed allocations to a few university projects around the country, there's almost no funding for basic research, capacity development, or infrastructure acquisition for the programs working in information security. As an example, the center I direct at Purdue University, Sirius, is the nation's leading center in multidisciplinary information security research and education, with over 80 faculty, and we are graduating nearly 25% of the nation's PhDs in information security. Sirius, in its 9-year lifetime, has never received any government support, although some individual faculty have received funding from agencies such as the NSF for individual research. As is the case with many of my peer institutions, our ability to make progress in education and research is limited by a severe lack of resources. In February 2005, as Chairman Bouyer noted, the President's Information Technology Advisory Committee issued this report based on hearings and considerable study by many experts, myself included. That report was entitled Cybersecurity, A Crisis of Prioritization. It described the nature of the problems with cybersecurity and some of the trends. It also analyzed the inadequate federal response to those challenges. It outlined in some detail an agenda to begin to address some of our cybersecurity problems. The response to that report was similar to other reports that have been issued over the years. Only one of the four recommendations has been acted upon, and the PTAC was disbanded. I encourage members of the committee to carefully read the PTAC Cybersecurity Crisis Report. I participated in the research and writing of that document, and it goes into considerable detail about problems such as those faced at the VA and issues behind our cybersecurity deficit, as well as making some concrete suggestions on how those issues might be addressed. I've also included some other recommendations in my written testimony, including a comprehensive list of recommendations for data privacy protection as developed by the ACM's U.S. Public Policy Committee. I welcome your questions and working with you to help address these problems. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Did all the members receive one of these?
Yes. They,
everybody's got one? All right. Thank you. Mr. Brody, you're now recognized.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Filner, and members of the committee, my name is Bruce Brody. As a veteran, I am very grateful for the opportunity to address this distinguished committee today. With the chair's permission, I'll provide a brief overview and then submit a longer statement for the record.
Hearing no objections, ordered. Dr. Spafford, did you have a written statement you'd like to be submitted for the record?
It has been.
Mr. Cook, do you have a written statement you'd like submitted for the record?
Submitted.
All right. Hearing no objections, ordered. All statements will be submitted for the record.
I am the Vice President for Information Security at Input, a market research firm based in Reston, Virginia. From 2001 to 2004, I was the Associate Deputy Assistant Secretary for Cyber and Information Security at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And from 2004 until January of this year, I was the Associate Chief Information Officer for Cybersecurity at the Department of Energy. I believe that I am the only person ever to have served as the Chief Information Security Officer at two cabinet-level departments. Like the members of this committee and my fellow veterans, I view the loss of personal information of more than 26 million veterans as willful disregard for responsible behavior and blatant contempt for established federal security and privacy requirements by senior VA leadership. I urge this committee to look very carefully at the following factors, which I believe contribute to the decades of information security and privacy neglect at the VA, and that have been documented by the Inspector General and the Government Accountability Office. First, someone with appropriate substantive expertise must be empowered to set and enforce privacy and cybersecurity requirements, to include the physical security requirement for how such records are maintained and the personnel security requirements for who is allowed access to such records. When I was first introduced to this committee in April of 2001, I thought that the Secretary had hired me for that purpose. However, the apparent authorities invested in the CIO in the Clinger-Cohen Act and the Paperwork Reduction Act and in both the CIO and the CISO in the Computer Security Act of 1987, the Government Information Security Reform Act of 2000, and finally in the Federal Information Security Management Act of 2002 were not accepted by VA's leadership. I quickly learned that the Department's Chief Information Officer only had authority to advise, encourage, support, and persuade the administrations insofar as information technology programs were concerned. In addition, I learned that the CIO had no authority to direct compliance. These points were captured in a memorandum from the Assistant General Counsel, dated October 6, 2000. Difficulties with this advise, encourage, support, and persuade approach to the CIO's management authority were raised at a March 12, 2002 Oversight Committee hearing by both Chairman Buyer and Ranking Member Carson, who questioned the ability of the then CIO to get the job done without line authority. Later that year, Secretary Principi took actions to direct the centralization and enhance line authority of the CIO function, presumably acting on the recommendations of this committee. Unfortunately, the Secretary's direction met with bureaucratic inertia and cultural resistance and was never fully implemented. Subsequent to my arrival at the VA, the Government Information Security Reform Act, followed by the Federal Information Security Management Act, were enacted in 2000 and 2002, respectively. Not being an attorney, I cannot offer legal opinions about what the words of these statutes mean. I can only apply common sense to the purpose of these important pieces of legislation. It seemed to me that if, after all was said and done, the opinion of the Assistant General Counsel issued in October of 2000 was correct, then the Congress went through nonsensical amounts of effort to produce the legislation and provide such details concerning specific responsibilities. It became all the more apparent that clarification was needed following the MS Blaster malicious software incident in the second half of 2003. In advance of what proved to be a serious malicious software attack represented by MS Blaster, my office provided the necessary alerts and also distributed notification concerning the necessary patches throughout the VA enterprise. These alerts were widely ignored, and VA networks were savaged as a result. The apparent authorities invested in the CIO and the Clinger-Cohen Act and in the CIO and CISO and FISMA did not seem to be accepted by VA or its leadership. As a result, I concluded that there was no longer any point in attempting to introduce cybersecurity changes in the VA unless there was a clear statement of authority to do so. That was when I requested the General Counsel opinion about FISMA authorities for the CIO and the CISO. Just prior to the MS Blaster attack, I had requested a clarification from the General Counsel concerning the responsibilities of the CIO under FISMA for national security and non-national security information and information systems. In a memorandum signed by the General Counsel on August 1, 2003, it was reinforced that the various security functions of the Department, specifically information security, physical security, and personnel security, would remain under the authority of their respective offices. According to the memorandum, the CIO was allowed to issue policies pertaining to information security, but the daily operations of security clearance determinations, investigations, physical storage, and related activities were not to be placed under the purview of the CIO. Subsequent to the MS Blaster attack, I requested a clarification from the General Counsel concerning the authority of the CIO to enforce compliance with security legislation and regulations. In a memorandum signed by the General Counsel on April 7, 2004, It was asserted that the CIO cannot order or enforce compliance with information security requirements. Because FISMA used the word ensure instead of the word enforce, the General Counsel stated that the only recourse for the CIO when a security requirement was violated was to complain to the Secretary. The result of these two opinions was extremely unfortunate for the Department. In effect, the first of these memos fragmented security authorities, and the second said that the CIO had no authority to enforce policies or hold people accountable for violating policies. These memos accurately captured and reinforced the culture of the Department, where resistance to central authority and doing business according to hundreds of different local practices have always been the norm. In day-to-day operations, these memos ensured that the fragmentation of security authorities enabled a lack of background investigation for individuals with access to VA network systems and resources, the unchecked access to VA information by foreign corporations and foreign nationals, limited to non-existent logical and physical access controls for major medical systems, the disruption and denial of service from malicious software attacks such as MS Blaster, and hundreds of other negative information security findings as highlighted in the reports of the Independent Public Auditor, the Inspector General, and the Government Accountability Office. I would ask the committee if it agrees that the Clinger-Cohen Act and FISMA do not require the Secretary, CIO, and CISO to set and enforce the security requirements of the FISMA legislation. If FISMA and the Clinger-Cohen Act do not convey the authority and accountability for enforcing security and privacy requirements, perhaps the Congress needs to amend these bills to so state. My personal experience is that the mismatch of authority and accountability for the CIO and CISO affects other departments and agencies to the same extent that it affects the VA, and I encourage legislative action to clarify this situation and possibly prevent more serious incidents from occurring. But the bottom line for the VA was that the two General Counsel memos reinforced the VA culture, and the VA culture is the root cause of this problem. The VA culture can be highlighted even further in the paper trail of non-concurrences on VA Directive 6500, the Information Security Program. My second recommendation is that policies, procedures, and assignments of accountability regarding security and privacy issues cannot be held hostage to the individual interests of the senior officials whose concurrence must be obtained prior to review by the Secretary. In this regard, I invite the committee's attention to the paper trail of non-concurrence on VA Directive 6500, the Information Security Program. On January 16, 2004, VHA non-concurred on VA Directive 6500, disagreeing with a blanket approach to background investigations, opposing any requirement to assure that corporations having access to VA systems and data be American-owned, in other words, subject to U.S. laws and within the reach of U.S. courts if U.S. laws were breached. VHA also opposed any requirements that visitor personnel be escorted at VA facilities, resisted the ability of the Associate Deputy Assistant Secretary for Cyber and Information Security to establish mandatory penalties for noncompliance. VHA's nonconcurrence specifically dealt with the offshoring of sensitive information such as medical records for transcriptions. Other significant nonconcurrences on VA Directive 6500 are included in my written testimony for the record. The memos by the General Counsel and the paper trail of non-concurrence on VA Directive 6500 are indicative of a culture of resistance to central authority and refusal to accept anything other than business as usual. They also highlight the decentralized authority enjoyed by the administrations and program offices who are empowered to define the role and authority of the CIO as they see fit in order to perpetuate their parochial interests. Most of all, these documents make it clear that the CIO and the subordinate CISO have no authority to do anything other than issue policies. But on top of that, they can only issue policies that the administrations and program offices allow them to issue through the concurrence process. Once issued, the CIO and CISO have no authority to enforce these watered-down policies that they are permitted to put in place. As a third recommendation, let me suggest to you that the CIO budget, including cybersecurity and privacy budgets, cannot be held hostage by the administrations and program offices. Since funds are not directly appropriated to the CIO by Congress, security and privacy initiatives depend on the funding support of the very offices that have historically been the cause of the problems being addressed. Fourth, I recommend you create a legislative requirement that would suspend all executive and senior bonuses in the VA until the environment for which the executive is responsible receives a clean bill of security health from the IG and the competent senior official placed in charge of security. There are more than 26 million veterans and active duty personnel who are uncertain if the loss of their personal information will bring them financial harm. These veterans deserve better because they have served our country well. Unfortunately, the VA has not served them well, and the VA must make the necessary amends. If the VA cannot reinvent itself and change its culture dramatically, then I would beg the Congress to do it for them and to do it for our nation's deserving veterans. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my statement. Thank you for the opportunity to appear here.
Thank you, Mr. Rohde. Mr. Cook, you're now recognized.
Chairman Bowyer.
Mr. Cook, can you turn that microphone on and pull it close to you, please? Thank you.
Oh, it wasn't on. I apologize. Thank you for inviting ID Analytics to testify on ways to help victims of the recent Veteran Affairs data breach. My name is Mike Cook. I am a co-founder of ID Analytics, a San Diego-based company focused exclusively on stopping identity fraud. I have worked in the field of credit risk and fraud prevention for 20 years. ID Analytics helps stop identity fraud through our ID network, a real-time identity fraud prevention system formed through a consortium of leading companies dedicated to protecting their customers from identity fraud. Our ID network gathers information from applications for credit, change of address, and other identity risk information from companies including half of the top 10 U.S. banks, almost all major wireless carriers, and a leading retail card issuer. Hundreds of times each day, our technology helps stop fraudsters from obtaining credit services and merchandise in innocent consumers' names. We think it's important to make you aware that ID Analytics does not market or sell the data we collect in the ID network for any purpose to anyone. I'm here today because ID Analytics has unique expertise and knowledge of data breaches and their risk. To date, we are the only public or private entity that has studied the harm resulting from actual data breaches. Should any committee member have interest, I'd be happy to provide a copy of our white paper analyzing the harm from four actual well-publicized data breaches involving more than 500,000 breached consumer identities. I'd first like to put this breach into context. At this point, no one knows the scope of risk veterans are facing. The most dangerous data breaches are targeted thefts where the thief committed the breach solely for the purpose of taking the consumer data. In this case, the purpose of the theft is unclear. Was the thief targeting a laptop or the data held on it? I don't believe we know that answer today. If the data is misused, we can expect it to be misused in the following ways. It's likely the fraudsters will mainly attack the credit card industry. Stolen identities are an asset, and sophisticated fraudsters can get the best rate of return by fraudulently obtaining credit cards and then making fensible purchases. Secondly, because the file contains so many identities, it's likely that the fraudsters will use the stolen identities once or twice and never again to increase their approval rate. Low use rates of individual veteran identities will make detection more difficult for the lending community. Again, if the data is misused, sophisticated fraudsters will spread the misuse of identities across differing locations within a city or even across different states to avoid detection. The worst case scenario is that the veteran file finds its way to a public distribution source such as the Internet. If this happens, the stolen identities will lose their connection to the VA data breach, and groups of fraudsters might actually actively trade that data among the fraud community. Subsequently, more people might have access and could misuse those identities on a grander scale. We know from additional research conducted earlier this year that the misuse rate of data traded on the Internet can climb substantially and exceed the average rate of identity theft of 1.5%. Some consumer advocates estimate that the value of a stolen identity ranges from $25 to $75, depending on the available personal information associated with that identity. So because of the value of the data itself, wide distribution should be a concern and should drive a real sense of urgency to try to recover the stolen data as fast as possible. So what can the VA do now? Over the course of the last year, ID Analytics has developed breach monitoring technology. With this technology, the VA can answer three essential questions about the data breach. The first question they can answer is the breach data being misused by fraudsters today? Secondly, if it is being misused, can we identify the specific veterans harmed by this misuse and provide them with additional victim assistance? And thirdly, if the breached file is being misused, at what locations are those breached consumer identities being misused so that law enforcement can stop the misuse and potentially recover the breached data file? How does this technology work? Simply put, when thieves use a breached file, they leave tracks. In order to obtain credit or other goods, in a veteran's name, a fraudster would have to manipulate that veteran's identity information on a new account application. For instance, if a fraudster applies for a credit card in a veteran's name, the fraudster needs to change the address so he or she can collect a new credit card from the bank. The fraudster will change the veteran's phone number for personal and employment verification purposes. He or she may use these same addresses and phone numbers to commit identity theft against other identities that were part of that same breach. Our ID network, which receives hundreds of thousands of applications and other identity risk events per day, can identify these types of anomalous changes and relationships across a breached file, regardless of the size of the breached file. We believe this technology can be significant to the Department of Veterans Affairs for the following reasons. It can help identify any organized misuse of the personal data that has happened so far. The analysis can quickly identify veterans who may have been victimized so that additional victim assistance can be expedited to them. It can actively monitor the file for possible misuse. This technology can help provide law enforcement a way to identify those individuals who have either stolen the file or have misused it to commit identity theft, to stop further misuse, and to recover the lost file. The analysis can help to determine if the file is in use by more than one individual or one cohesive group. And finally, breach monitoring provides a deterrent effect once publicly announced. Thieves should be aware that if they try to misuse any data from the VA data breach, they do so at their own peril. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to present this testimony.
All right, I have two areas I'm going to touch on, and then I'm going to yield to my colleagues. Yesterday, when the VA made their announcement of credit monitoring, I don't know too much beyond that, nor do I know where they're going or how they define it. But my first reaction was I was concerned. And let me explain why I was concerned. The concern is that are we creating a false expectancy among veterans that if the VA is now going to just be doing credit monitoring, they'll look at my credit reports, I'm safe. Somehow that's going to provide a safe haven. And it's a reason I did not issue a statement yesterday. I couldn't stand up and cheer because I still have great fears. So let me turn to you, and I want you to tell me, Steve, I agree with you or I disagree with you. You should cheer about this. Because here in light, let me take it now. The next step is that if they know what they're doing, they're going to take this, and it's going to be synthetic identity theft. So, Mr. Cook, as you identified, that you take you look at the granulation of the information, and then you begin to change it a little bit. So, I take Dr. Eugene Spafford. I got your Social Security number, and I got your address, and know what your wife's name is. So, I make the application, but I change the last two digits of your Social Security number. So now I obtain that credit card and I begin to make purchases. I do other things that spoil your life, Dr. Spafford. But if all I'm doing is monitoring the credit report, that nefarious action by me is not going to show up on the credit report, as I understand. So now let me yield to the panel and say, Steve, you got it right, or Steve, you got it wrong.
Chairman Bowyer, we've done a lot of analysis on fraud and how they use data, and I don't believe the identity, the people, if they use this data, are going to perpetrate synthetic fraud. The reason for that is synthetic fraud is when you don't have any data available to you. So I could go out and use a name, and I could create a social, and we've seen they do things called social security number tumbling to make them get past the validity check, if you will. So people who perpetrate synthetic fraud do that because they don't have access to data. And the analysis that we've done shows that if they perpetrate synthetic fraud, they don't perpetrate identity theft. So I would probably disagree and say I don't think synthetic fraud is going to be the case here. I think it's going to be identity theft. And I think that credit monitoring might help those consumers who take the credit monitoring up on that offer. It may help them detect some of the fraud that's happening to them. But it's not going to be the only solution that's available to them. Here's the reason for that. Credit monitoring is going to tell somebody that you had an application that was filed in your name. By that point, it's probably too late because, as I said in my opening statement, if these guys who took the file are sophisticated enough and use it the right way, they'll use the identity once or twice and never again. So by the time that monitoring alert gets to the consumer, it's already out there and there's nothing really they can do about it. So I think credit monitoring has its place for consumers. If you think about consumers, we all have about a 1.5 to 3% chance of having identity theft happen to us. The chance of a veteran having identity theft happening to them because of this breach file is far less than that, just because of the magnitude of this. So I think credit monitoring is fine for consumers if they can afford it. But we think that there are better technologies to detect if there's misuse, to locate where it is so you can go and try and recover the file, and thirdly, to really detect if there's misuse for a specific veteran, and then you can help that veteran out.
Mr. Chairman, monitoring detects after something has occurred, as Mr. Cook already mentioned, but credit fraud is not the only concern that should be present. As I noted in my comments, we now have all of this information on individuals who have ably served their country, and that information can be used to get replacement identification cards, passports, driver's licenses, and other information for individuals to have a clean record or even a trusted record to go out and cause trouble. That when they run up a criminal record or misbehavior under those identities, it's not going to show up in a credit report, but more likely in a criminal report or a civil action. And monitoring is not going to prevent that or even assist with that.
I mean, if I, by way of a consumer product, and if in fact we are into the marketplace to purchase a consumer product, my sensing is that we don't want to just monitor. We want to do data verification. We want to be able to look at identity verification and examine perhaps even insurance-based products. Because we have a choice. Either, I threw out this suggestion, and Judiciary Committee runs off yesterday, and they create the claims adjudication process. All they said was we were thinking about it. Isn't it amazing about this institution? It's in consideration, and boom, they go off and they do it. Now we've got to tell them, wait a minute. So I just want all of you to know, when you read about this today, we're going to put all this a little on hold so we can understand all this a little bit better. If, in fact, we can't, this is what we need to know from the VA. I'm not going to go with you, Tim, on this one, unless you're prepared to talk about it today. But if there's a product out there whereby we got to monitor this for almost 3 years, we need to give them the tools out there when we do this bid on this contract. And if we can purchase that insurance up there using proper algorithms to know what our exposure would be on the contract, is to go with an insurance-based product out there whereby the veteran is protected up to $25,000. That way we wouldn't have to get into the, quote, claims adjudication process. We accept the responsibility. We the government, have lost the data. But there's some things for us as members to consider. The last point I'll make, yield to Mr. Filner, is the point that the witnesses discussed and that we have concerns about, and that is, in our society, we believe in something that is very congruent, and that is, if I say that you have the responsibility to do something, then it must be coupled with the authority to act. And if I were to say that you have the responsibility, but you know that you do not have authority, it then creates an asyntactic situation, and meaning it results in something that is incongruent. And if you have something that is incongruent, you then have an opinion that is called a heterodox. And a heterodox is something that is completely out of the norm of society's communications. So I say to the fireman, you have the responsibility to put out the fire, but you have no authority to hook up to city water. So the secretary turns to the CIO and tells them that you've got the responsibility to do quality assurance, i.e. cybersecurity, etc., But then you have no authority to enforce or tell anybody to do anything. Very concerning. And I appreciate all of your testimonies. Mr. Filner, you're recognized.
Thank you, and I think the testimony you have, obviously, great expertise, and you have also give us very specific recommendations which we can act on, and I think that's very useful. Mr. Cook, did you try to talk to the VA about the kind of technology you have and the services you could provide?
Yes, sir.
And what happened with that? I mean,
we're in continued discussions with them, and we're hoping to be able to provide them services.
As I understood what you do, it goes beyond what their announcement was yesterday.
Yes, sir. Well, I looked at the announcement that they made. There was a small piece of that announcement that talked about looking at other breach monitoring or breach mediation solutions, and I'm assuming that might have been looking at us and other technologies that are available that do what we do, which, to the best of my knowledge, we're the only ones who do that.
Okay, so they are talking to you, and they're going to become aware of your expertise in this. But I just read an ad from, I think, Visa, and they said they have, I think they called it neural technology.
Right.
That they are able to provide their millions of cardholders with the knowledge of if anything anomalous happens. Is that equivalent to what you're doing, or similar? Or?
It's similar but different, if you will. Visa and other companies provide different modeling techniques. One is the one that you mentioned, where they can look at an account, if you will, and look at if I'm using my credit card properly, right? If I have lived in Texas my whole life and then all of a sudden I start using something overseas and I start to buy a lot of fensible goods, jewelry or something, that's an anomalous pattern in an account behavior. And there are technologies that do that. We're the only ones that really apply that kind of technique to an identity. So Visa and others can look at account. We look at an identity and look at anomalous patterns about an identity and how it behaves over time, and then also how it might relate to other people. And that's the way that we are able to detect if a breached file would be misused in an organized way.
Mr. Booyer was concerned about raised expectations for veterans. If we did use your system in this case, I mean, are we giving them the security that they need or the assurances they need?
You would be. You had mentioned that credit monitoring is not going to catch criminal activity. And so when you look at a problem like fraud, you generally have to throw a couple different solutions at it. And you're still not going to catch all the fraud that there is. Our technology, I think, will definitely detect if a fraud is misusing the file and they're misusing it more than five or six times in an anomalous way, we would be able to detect that misuse and then provide that information to the VA.
Well, I thank you, and I hope we pursue that. Again, we'll have to analyze, and if competitors are not, if there are none, then I hope they'll think about you.
May I make one more point on credit monitoring? And I meant to mention this. And whatever solution the VA chooses, and we've talked with them about this, it's important not to publish how long that solution is going to be in place. For instance, if you're going to do credit monitoring for free for 1 year, anyone who took the file and has an intent to misuse the file will sit on that for 1 year and 1 day, and then they'll start to use it. So,
but Mr. Cook, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Please.
These will go out under an RFP. They're publicly bid on, and people are going to know.
Okay.
I just want to let you know the reality of government procurement.
Sure.
Mr. Brody, I have used the analogy for this data breach as I used the Katrina situation. I mean, at first it seems like a natural disaster, and you got to deal with it. But when you look further, you could have predicted the consequences of a Category 5 hurricane. You knew what levees would have to be built, and it turned out we didn't do it. In this case, too, it's some thief, they're not going to use it, stole this stuff. We couldn't have known that. But if you look at it further, not only were policies, I don't know if there were any policies in place to keep that data from going to the the person's home. I think you're going to have trouble, Mr. McLean, to fire this guy when if there's no policies that say you can't do this. I mean, that's a real problem. But not only did we not have policies about taking the data home, but you have outlined a whole, you know, years and years long indifference to doing this. So it seems to me accountability, it's not just a natural disaster. There's accountability of management. And I assume you would hold responsible for this breach the top management people, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as Chairman pointed out, the mismatch of accountability and authority was what we lived on a daily basis. I was the Associate Deputy Assistant Secretary for Heterodox.
He made up that word. Now you're going to use it. I mean, come on.
I mean, but even in the case of MS Blaster, for instance, that one incident where the VA networks were savaged as a result of a malicious software attack, a root cause analysis was performed by the Veterans Health Administration, bringing in a distinguished doctor who has history in root cause analysis, and the analysis concluded that the CIO's office was probably at fault because when it issued the warnings to put the patches in place, it didn't sufficiently convince everybody that we were really serious about putting the patches in place.
When you testified to this committee in your role as a CIO, was it?
CISO.
CISO. I mean, were you as – I mean, I don't remember. I don't think I was here, but were you as frank and as open as you were just now? Or were you able to be?
No, I was not.
I mean, was that made clear to you? Or
yes.
I mean, how do we get around that, by the way? It seems to me that if the legislation does need to be modified, something about, you know, the independence of the person. It's a difficult thing. You're in a chain of command. If the legislation is giving you authority, not from the secretary but from the Congress, then I guess we should give you the authority to testify, too, without going through OMB and everything else. I'm just trying to think ahead what would the problems be.
You're certainly thinking through all the right issues, yeah. Believe me.
Has a successor been chosen to you?
Oh, yes. He's been in place for roughly 2 years.
And nothing much has changed with that, as far as you know, huh?
No. The culture is still the culture.
I mean, your testimony is very disturbing. We knew about it. You heard me say similar words that you do. So, I mean, there have been people talking to you, and we've known about it. But you put it in a way that is extremely, extremely disturbing. I mean, if the veterans who we are responsible for, and you properly put it back. This is all about the veterans, not about an organization, not about turf, not about, you know, covering up for whatever. It's about the veterans. And if they're not, I mean, they've lost a lot of confidence, obviously. And your testimony makes it apparent that there's going to be a broader scale of changes than let's just figuring out this particular one, as bad as this is. You know, I mean, this data breach compared to the 13,000, you know, D.C. employees, or, you know, the reward that they have offered, 50,000 compared to the street value of, what, half a billion or something that was said. So, I mean, the magnitude is incredible. But even that is we can solve relative, you know, in some ways through technology. But you bring in an even broader problem. And I think, Mr. Chairman, again, you have been talking about this for several years. I think everybody understands now why. And we have a chance as a committee, as a Congress, as a nation to really make the kind of changes that will benefit our veterans and keep them secure in the years to come. Thank you.
I appreciate the gentleman's line of questioning. And you were very kind to me. I don't want it to be spun out there that I'm upset about credit monitoring. It's monitoring plus. So I'm glad you explored the other tools that are available, and that's what we want to make sure as members, that whatever the request for proposal that goes out, that it has a broader base to it. And I think that's what we need to consider as we work with our appropriators and figuring out how they're also going to be paying for this and out of what pools of money and where does it come from. So we don't want it to be just monitoring. It's also the other tools. To correct the record for you, Mr. Villarakis, you said that you are the only player in the space. Are you aware of a company called Intellius?
I am not.
All right. Okay. Just to let you know, there are other players in the space. Mr. Villarakis, you're now recognized.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've heard, great testimony, obviously. I've heard Mr. Brody use the term root cause. We are concerned about the veterans. This is a veterans committee. But I think that our concerns really ought to go past that point. Now, I'm not talking turf here or anything of that nature, but Mr. Spafford, you were part of this president's PTAC, acronyms for every damn thing up here. But you're part of this group, and you all worked on it for approximately a year, from what I understand. Did you all come to the conclusion at all that there was no authority, enforcement authority that existed among these chief information officers?
When we did our study, that was not a specific question we looked at. However, in talking to people across government agencies and our own experience, we have found that in many places, individual unit directors in the military, unit commanders, feel that they can override policy whenever it gets in their way. And there is a problem throughout in being able to ensure that security policies and procedures are appropriately carried out. Unfortunately, without some training, the people who are making these decisions do not understand the consequences of overriding those decisions.
The PTAC, of course, was not designed just to look into the VA department. It was designed for government-wide, right?
Yes, sir. All right. Nationally.
In your recommendations, apparently you all failed to point out and to emphasize this lack of authority to enforce. Is that true?
We were looking at the state of information technology across the nation, not simply in the government. And so our recommendations were for the state of cybersecurity as part of the national infrastructure, not simply government itself. So that was not one of the topic areas, was how government...
Well, you were basically given areas to cover, and you're limited to those areas?
Effectively so, yes.
But you have now come to the conclusion, and as you were speaking, Mr. Brody was shaking his head. I didn't even look over at Mr. Cook. Much of the problem is, I mean, first of all, you all mentioned culture. God knows that is a hell of a problem, not only in the VA, but I suppose probably in all departments and agencies. But shouldn't we be concerned that apparently the lack of authority that is so very, very significant here, so very necessary, for crying out loud, does not exist. Something just flashed. But anyhow, does not exist, or apparently does not exist, or doesn't exist adequately in all the other agencies and departments in the government?
My comments about that in particular were based on my own personal experience rather than the committee. That was a separate report. But yes, I have seen in many agencies, including Department of Defense, there is a lack of concomitant authority to go with the responsibility. In many agencies, such as it appears to be at the Veterans Administration, and in many companies, the person who is given the responsibility for security but no authority, the real position should have a label of scapegoat, because that's all that one can do is take the blame if you can't affect any change. And this is all too common in the area of security, because those of us who understand the risks and want to implement the changes are resisted because it costs money. It changes the way people do things. And so it's a very common problem throughout government and industry.
Mr. Brody.
I can only concur. My direct observation was at the Departments of Veterans Affairs, Department of Energy, and Department of Defense. And in all three cases, direct observation, there is no authority resident with the accountability function of the senior IT official.
And you all agree that this, I mean, we can talk about maybe solving or fixing this particular problem ultimately or whatever the case may be. We're spending so much time on this that we should be spending on other veterans' matters, claims and the lack of the delay in claims and health care and things of that nature. But I don't know. Does the president know that significant part of this overall picture, the lack of authority to enforce, does not exist? It was not part of your report that went to him.
No, sir.
So he does not know. I mean, he doesn't know by virtue of this report in any case.
We were asked specifically to look at the status of cybersecurity research and technology transfer in the country and how effective it was. That was the nature of that report.
Well, you've said that, yeah.
Yes. So as to what the president knows or does not know, I can't comment.
I just find it illuminating that the same body that gave us the Federal Information Security Management Act was not aware of this mismatch of accountability and authority.
Are we accomplishing very much of anything here if we don't really look to the root cause, not only in the VA? I mean, this same sort of thing's going to happen in other departments and other agencies if it hasn't already. Well, FTC, what's this? Federal Trade Commission. We just got the word. And we're hearing about other agencies or other departments. Should we have legislation? And I guess legislation is only as good as the people who are supposed to be carrying it out, that would mandate, for crying out loud, that there be some sort of authority. We're going to hear from the council in a little while. I guess who's going to tell us that the authority is not there. But should we have legislation that would do it, not just with the VA? And, of course, obviously, it would be something that would be applicable to all of the other committees, which might be just enough of a reason to kill the legislation because, you know, it's assigned to other committees, too. But shouldn't we do something like that? I mean, isn't that part of the root cause, getting to the root cause of all this?
I am on record with the Committee on Government Reform as pointing out that the major flaws in FISMA include the accountability versus the authority mismatch, as well as the issue of FISMA not necessarily measuring the right categories of information security.
And you're on record of saying, and you all are on record of saying, that basically you can't ever solve this unless you have that, you take care of that particular area. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. Let me ask, we understand that houses in the neighborhood of where this took place have also were burglarized around apparently during the same period of time. And I guess they haven't been tied, as it's tied up into whether the same person did it or whatever the case may be. But I think that the impression is that the person who took this did not know what he or she was doing, or what they did not know what they had. Are we wrong by virtue of holding these hearings and all this publicity out there and that sort of thing? Is it likely that the thief or thieves know by now what they have in their possession?
Based on the reports that I've seen, it is entirely possible, because of the delay in reporting, that if the thief was only interested in the physical computer, it had already left his or her possession by the time the news was released.
Why would that be? Why would it have left?
They would have sold it immediately. Those kinds of thefts are usually to obtain money for drugs or other.
But whoever they sold it to, the problem still potentially exists with that person, right?
Very often those systems are completely wiped of whatever material is present, so they can't be traced back. But the second part of your question about holding these hearings, I think, are very important, and it also goes to your earlier question about, is something being accomplished? These kinds of problems have been happening for several years and are going to happen more frequently, and it is very important that we all understand these problems and address them in some way. So I certainly applaud whatever you're doing in this regard.
Okay. Mr. Brody, you agree. Mr. Cook? It's very brief, very quickly, because my time is up.
I agree.
Yeah. Mr. Cook, you agree?
I agree. If they do know that they have it, I know what I would do with that data. I would take it in the backyard and bury it.
You would what?
I'm sorry. If I knew that I had the information, I would take it in the backyard and bury it in a very deep hole, because I think that there's so much
scrutiny and so much interest in, you know, who has that file, I think there's other data that would I'd probably try and take other than
okay. The okay, so actually then you feel that hearings like this will tend to maybe convince the thief that they'd better bury it and not try to use it.
We have done analysis on different breaches. And one of the breaches, there was a public announcement that was made. And what we noticed was after the public announcement was made, the use of the file, the use of the names went way down. So we do think the public announcement helps a good deal. The concern I would have is that over time, that data can get out. And if that information gets out over time, all of a sudden, the attachment to the VA data breach might go away, and it just becomes names and socials that can be misused. And if that's the case, and if the information finds its way onto the Internet, over time, veterans can see identity theft happen to them from this breach. But we don't know that.
Okay.
Thank you, Ryan.
I feel a little better. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Mr. Rochot, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for having this hearing. Really appreciate your willingness to stay on top of it. I also want to thank the panelists as well. It's been very informative. Mr. Brody, you had mentioned that VHA disagreed with the draft directive 6500 regarding the medical transcription services. Can you recall what they said and why you thought that this to be a faulty reasoning for not complying with it?
Yeah. I mean, in general, their position was that the language of their contract with the transcription company was sufficient control. But my office tried to point out to them that, number one, they weren't monitoring or auditing whether or not the contractor was in compliance with the contract. Number two, the outsourcing to a foreign company created some issues related to whether or not the individuals that had access to this data had criminal backgrounds or potentially ties to terrorist organizations. And number three, foreign organizations, foreign corporations deny us the ability to address any issues in U.S. courts should it come to that. And when we pointed those things out to them, they you know, took them under advisement and went off and did their own thing.
Thank you. Secondly, Mr. Brody, specifically, what were there any information or cybersecurity weaknesses in the VISTA system? If so, what were they, and what could be done to fix them?
The committee might find it interesting. I recall reading in the VA publication that's distributed in the hallways and near the elevators a few years ago, where there was an article on VISTA, and it was declared in the article by, you know, senior VA officials how proud they were that they were able to develop VISTA Underground without any involvement by the headquarters. And so I don't know what the software looks like inside VISTA. I do know that as of 2 years ago, it had no access control whatsoever, and I don't know if that's been corrected to date. So I would encourage the committee to potentially take a look at maybe do a security audit of VISTA and see what they find.
Thank you. You had mentioned that you'd worked with the DOD and the Department of Energy, and you mentioned some of the same things about who's in charge. Did you witness similar problems with the other agencies as far as security that you witnessed at the VA, and does the DOE suffer from another agency's similar resistance to change? Even though the authority might not have been the same, has it been that resistance in the other agencies, that culture, so to speak?
Overall, yes. I mean, not to quote Yogi Berra, but their similarities are different, and that means that in the national security world, which includes DOD and DOE, there tends to be a little greater appreciation for across the population for the needs to be to operate more securely. Nonetheless, the decentralization, especially in an environment like DOE, has created similar fragmented security issues as exists in many of the other civilian agencies.
Thank you. And is it technology difficult to centralize the IT operation within the VA, do you think?
There are some complexities associated with technology, but overall, technology is not the problem. I mean, the technology complexities relate to, in the case of the VA, some of these very older systems that are no longer supported by the original manufacturer, and those just probably need to be retired or migrated. But overall, the technology part of this problem is not the hard part of the problem. It is the cultural part of this problem.
In my last question, in your opinion, do you feel that the 26 million records, is that a national or a non-national security problem?
If you take the strict definition of FISMA, it's a non-national security problem, but I feel that when you begin aggregating the kinds of information that can be contained in those kinds of databases, you are very perilously close to a national security problem.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yield back, balance my time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Moran?
Chairman, thank you very much. Mr. Cook, you said something in your testimony or response to a question, I think, that caught my attention that I don't understand, and it dealt with the percentages of Americans that are subject to identity theft, and I think it was 1.5 to 3%. And then you indicated that the veterans who were on this this computer information was something less. Would you explain that to me?
Sure. What I mean by that is we've done a lot of analysis, and what we know is that the size of the breach is very important to the misuse rate of that breach. If it is misused, and if you're a consumer, you want to be a part of a very large breach, because if you're a part of a 26.5 million record breach, then the probability of somebody picking your name out of that fairly large hat and using your name to commit identity theft is very, very small. If you have a, and let's just say, if you put your mail in your mailbox and somebody takes your mail out, I would consider that a data breach of one, right? And so there you would have a very high percentage of your name being misused. So the point I was trying to make is we all of us have about a 1.5 to 3% probability of identity theft happening to us during the course of a year. So there the probability of identity theft happening to a veteran is 1.5 to 3%, and so because now they're part of a very large data breach, it's only going to increase very slightly for them. Okay, but as a whole, it does mean that there'll be more victims of identity theft in the U.S. It does mean that.
What then is the value of the 26.5 million names, the information then on the street? 26.5 million is too much data for somebody who would be in the market for identity theft.
Well, it's a lot. If you're one person, it would take you, and we've done the math on it, it would take you about 12 lifetimes to use that one file. So it is a lot of data for one person to use. If they were to take it and disseminate it out on the Internet and try and sell it in packages, we've heard anywhere from $25 to $75 from consumer advocate groups who have said this is what they hear. So there's a lot of dollars that they could get by selling that data. But again, if I had taken the data and I knew that it was the VA file, I would run away from it, because I think there's going to be, such intense scrutiny on that file that people are going to be trying to find who's misusing that data.
What's the occurrence that causes us to know at some point in time that the security has been breached and the information is being used? What would you expect to be the first sign that there is a real problem?
Well, it'll be the anomalous behavior patterns that you would see in the file. For instance, there's 70, 60, 50 people in the room today, right? If all of our data was breached, 6 months from now, if we all started using the same cell phone number, that would be anomalous. If half of us started living in the same apartment complex, that would be anomalous. And that's how we can detect the misuse. It's the events that happen after the breach to a specific identity, and the way that we can pull those things together. And that, I think, would be your first indication that somebody's actually misusing that box.
And this would be announced, this would become known because some veteran would indicate something bad is happening in his or her life?
That's what credit monitoring would require, is that a consumer really kind of police their own report and then provide that data to a central source, and that's not being done. And there would be so much noise in that. Because, again, we have a percentage of identity theft that's going to happen to us. It would happen, It wouldn't be the consumer saying it. It would be our ability to look at the breached file and then look within our ID network and see applications that were filed in those veterans' names and then determine which of those applications were probably filed by the veteran and which of those applications might have been filed by a fraud ring who has access to that file.
Thank you. Mr. Brody, I think you've been asked this question, and maybe Dr. Spafford as well, but for my understanding, is there something unique about the VA that really, I mean, this happened with VA information, so the focus is on the VA. Is there, we talked about the culture, the atmosphere, the attitude, something unique about this place, or just any other governmental agency is at the same risk as the VA?
My observation would be that we need to be careful about not focusing entirely on this incident because, again, this was discovered almost by accident. How many more of these kind of incidents are out there, and not just at the VA where we know there are no controls in place to prevent it? We know there are no controls in place at other government departments and agencies where, you know, larger amounts of information may be on some employee's home computer or on some contractor's home computer. And so maybe the attention we're drawing to this incident could be creating an opportunity for some other bad actor out there, and that would be an unfortunate turn of event.
But the personnel at the VA aren't any more blind or indifferent or culturally resigned to where the status quo than any other place?
Not necessarily, no.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Spafford, did you have something you wanted to say to Mr. Moran?
I was simply going to say that there are some better and some worse. A lot depends upon their individual view of the data versus their mission. So some organizations, as Mr. Brody said, and working in national defense, will be more aware of that value. But in other places where they view that their mission, and unfortunately this is part of the problem of why this happened, the person who lost the data viewed that his mission was to get his reports done or get his work done rather than protecting and serving the veterans that the agency was supposed to be involved with. And where that disconnect occurs, you have more of these problems.
I would think Mr. Bullier's leadership on this issue and the hearings we're having and the focus of the national attention on this issue would cause other departments and agencies to have a desire to change their ways. Maybe that's just Kansas common sense, but I hope it works that way in Washington, that this is the catalyst that causes us all to think that, my gosh, what we are doing isn't quite adequate.
Well, as I noted and as Mr. Brody noted, this is not the first such incident. These kinds of things have been going on for years, and whoever's currently in the spotlight takes a fair amount of heat and vows never to do it again, and then someone else gets caught.
Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa. Ms. Herthas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the question that I know Mr. Mashute had a chance to pose to Mr. Brody and Mr. Moran's line of questioning. I do hope this presents an opportunity, as I explored in an earlier hearing, to evaluate whether or not we have the same weaknesses within the CIO organization across other federal agencies, of which you've had an opportunity to serve in two different agencies, and that while the VA is currently the one taking the heat, that whether it's USDA, EPA, DOE, others start taking steps and CIOs share information across agencies, and that we make the decisions in the Congress about the resources at the front end that are going to be necessary to prevent these types of situations that cost us far more at the back end. So let me just ask one question, because I know there's probably an interest in moving to the next panel as well. Mr. Brody, we've had some discussions here about the age of the various files within the VA. Is it technically difficult to encrypt or convert VA's older databases?
It is more difficult to encrypt the databases that are on older hardware platforms and older software operating systems that are no longer supported by any manufacturer. There are workarounds, and there are some complexities, but it's not impossible. And by and large, the technology part of this problem is not the hard part of this problem. The technology is available to solve most of the deficiencies identified by the IG and the GAO in the VA.
So if the technology isn't the problem, it's the resources and the obstructionism that we have to overcome that's the problem?
More or less, yes.
Okay. I yield back, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. I know Mr. Udall had to step out for just a moment, so let me we have votes that are going to occur at 12:15 to 12:30. So what I would say to Mr. McClain, I apologize, but it's life on the Hill. All right, so Mr. Brody, I'm going to go back to this, and we're going to get into this in the next panel with the general counsel about why they made certain decisions in their memorandums. But if I try to follow the logic that FISMA does not, let me restate this. According to the most recent FISMA report, VA has no agency-wide security policy. That's what the recent report says. If you were to design the security policies, what would be the key components to be included in that policy?
It would include the confidentiality, the integrity, the availability, and the accountability for the necessary controls in all VA's system, including the protection of data.
Dr. Spafford, would you agree with that?
Those would certainly be the core elements of the policy.
What kind of training would be necessary to implement such a policy, and what kind of time are we talking about?
It would depend, because there would be certain roles that would have to be trained. Managers across the agency would need a certain kind of training. Practitioners responsible for actually maintaining security devices would need a certain different kind of training. And by and large, a lot of that training is in place in the VA. We had put in place, following the incident in which some computer systems containing veterans' data were purchased by the television station in Indiana, we had put in place a program of practitioner professionalization, and we took 600 people through that program and certified them. But that's 600 in a population of over 200,000 that all need a significant degree of training.
And would we have any problems with VA personnel policies or labor practices?
Those cropped up from time to time, yes.
Such as?
The details escape me at the moment, but the fact of the matter is, whenever we tried to put in place any kind of policy that affected the day-to-day life of an individual, the resistance from the HR organization was fairly stiff.
Interesting. Mr. Udall?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Brody, you talked a little bit about security and the issues of security, and I wanted to ask you about under the Federal Information Security Management Act, are you comfortable with the distinctions between a national security database and a non-national security database, and how would you define these? And with respect to the specific information that was lost here, which category does it fall into? And are there any things that we should do in order to better protect ourselves in terms of these definitions?
Let's say I understand the definitions, and whether or not I'm comfortable with them, I spent 10 years in the intelligence community, so I understand that when you take what would appear outwardly to be non-sensitive information and begin aggregating it so that it starts to become more sensitive, you cross a fine line into what could be classified as national security information. According to the definitions that are incorporated in FISMA, that doesn't apply in this case. But I would argue that the aggregation of information in VA's systems can be of significant value to those who would wish to do this country harm.
And is there anything we can do to further protect in that area other than what you've already outlined here today?
Well, I mean, I actually raised this issue in 2001 when I arrived at the department, and I was told that that's the responsibility of the Office of Security and Law Enforcement, and thank you very much for your input. So, again, we're dealing with the fragmented security authorities across the department.
Several statements by the VA indicate that the employee who took home the data did so without authorization. If he was already authorized access to the data, what policy or regulation would have required further authorization? And do you recall if the IG or the GAO or any other entity ever commented on this as a weakness?
I'm not aware of any policy that would have prevented it, nor am I aware of any comment by any other party.
A changed management system developed after Secretary Principe attempted in 2002 to centralize the CIO function. This new system was characterized by significant non-line reporting. How well did this system work? Did that hybrid system approximate the federated management system and recently adopted by the VA?
Yeah, I would have to characterize the results of that as not not in keeping with the spirit of this committee's concerns as addressed in 2002. Once we got to that dotted line sort of authority thing, and in the face of or in the wake of the MS Blaster incident, we did an analysis internal to my office, and I'm sorry I don't have it present, but I'm sure we can probably draw it out of someone's files where we determined specifically who had responsibility for configuration control and configuration management in the department. And it turned out that as a result of the efforts by Secretary Principe to put that memo in place in 2002, there were no less than 13 separate places by which configuration control would be managed in the department.
Did Mr. Spafford or Mr. Cook, do you have any comments on anything you've heard and that I've raised here?
No, I missed.
No, okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yield back.
Brody, in your testimony, you touched on something that we as a committee had considered, and that was whether to elevate the CIO to the level of an undersecretary. And we thought about that as a committee when we put together our legislation, and I guess looking back on it, maybe we should have. Really, our inward discussions were dealing about with if you have a culture of resistance that I called the centurions of the status quo. And it's much easier for the three undersecretaries to run over the CIO, especially if they can then win. They all are then competing to win the support of the deputy secretary or the secretary. So I just want to let you know I got your message. I embrace it, and we as a committee are going to look back on your recommendations. With regard to data, when an individual feels, they went to the ball game, they just got their purse stolen, their pockets were picked. Now it's like, oh my gosh, I had 12 credit cards in there. It's now gone. What do I do? Who do I call? How long? My question to you is, what is the norm before an individual will begin to feel the bad effect?
There's been some analysis that's done on that. FTC, I think, has done some of the best analysis in another company called Identity Theft Resource Center. I think the average, and I'm not sure of this, but I think the average is about 6 months where they actually see it. Because what happens is you might get an inquiry on your credit report that you may not be aware of because you don't have credit monitoring. And then that account, if it's a wireless account or a credit card account, is opened, and then that fraudster might use that account. Some people will take the account, buy fenceable goods, and go bad right away. Others will use that account over time, as many as 18 months, so that they can do something that the industry calls bust out, where they can actually drive the account much higher than what the credit limit is. And so generally, consumers will find out that they're a victim of identity theft because they'll get a call either from the credit card issuing bank or the wireless company or from a collection company. So that's generally about 6 months to 7-8 months out. Now, if there is a fraudster who steals an identity and uses that identity over and over and over, and that consumer happens to have consumer monitoring, which is a very small percentage of people, then they may be aware of it within as quickly as 3 weeks, if you will.
All right. Our challenge here is to build a system, at the same time take care of the veterans and produce that product in Congress as we work with the administration. I want to thank you for taking your time to put together your testimony and for being here. I appreciate that. Mr. Brody, thank you. We asked you to do a job, and we put a patch over one eye, and we tied your good arm to your back. You did your very best. And I know it was hard and it was difficult. And we don't view you as a scapegoat. Because we are the more we do our forensics, the better understanding that we have about the culture and the problems and the resistance to change, as Mr. Filner had discussed. And we're going to embrace your recommendations, along with Dr. Spafford. Once again, let me thank you for helping your country. Your testimony is insightful and valuable to us as we formulate this legislation. Any other questions? This panel is now excused. If we could turn to the second panel, and even though we got a warning that votes will occur, Dr. Spafford, do you have to take off? Do you have to run? Dr. Spafford, do you have to catch a flight?
Later on.
Okay. Could you sit and listen to this next panel, or are you going to have to take off?
I can.
That's wonderful. Thank you. What I plan to do, Dr. Spafford, is I'd like you to listen to this panel, and then I'm going to circle back with you for that we could have a discussion. If we can't get it today, are you around Monday at Purdue University?
No, sir. I will be at a conference until Wednesday next week.
At a beautiful resort? Don't answer that.
Allegedly.
Great. It means you're in Toledo? Sorry, no, nothing against Toledo. All right. Hey. Sitting on our second panel is the General Counsel for the Department of Veterans Affairs, Mr. Tim McLean. Mr. McLean is confirmed by the Senate as the General Counsel for the Department of Veterans Affairs in April 2001. As General Counsel, he serves as the Chief Legal Advisor of the Secretary of Veterans Affairs and the Department's other senior leaders, and manages the Office of General Counsel, which is comprised of nearly 400 attorneys assigned throughout the United States. Mr. McLean also served as the VA Chief Management Officer from January 2005 to November 2005, responsible for the Department's budget, financial policy and operations, acquisitions, material management, real property asset management, environmental policy, and business oversight. Thank you very much for being here. And if you would also introduce Mr. Thompson, who accompanies you, and you will then be recognized.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, ranking member, and members of the committee, accompanying me this morning is Jack Thompson, who is the Deputy General Counsel at the VA, and he has over 30 years of service with the VA as an attorney. Also, I'd like to, if I could, ask that my full statement be made a part of the record.
All right. We do. If you'll rise and give me your right hand. Gentlemen, do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, help you God?
I do.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the legal implications of the May 3, 2006 theft from a VA employee's home of personal identifying information concerning veteran service members. This incident brings into sharp focus two federal laws that address similar issues, i.e. safeguarding personal information. Both the Privacy Act and the Federal Information Security Management Act, or FISMA, provide a framework for establishing agency safeguards to ensure the security and confidentiality of records. These statutes generally outline agency responsibilities and require the agency head and senior officials to ensure compliance with the law. Since we were made aware of this terrible situation, the employees of VA have worked tirelessly to ensure two things. One, that our normal services to veterans, including health care, benefits, burial, and memorial services, have continued uninterrupted. And two, that we address this situation in such a manner that it will minimize any adverse impact on a veteran. This is VA's problem, and we intend to address it head on. Secretary Nicholson has launched VA on a course that will result in VA being the gold standard for information security in the federal government. That is no easy task. VA is so large and with so many very vital programs that it will take a concerted effort on every employee's part to make that happen. Just as VA transformed its health care system from one of questionable quality in the early 1990s to today the recognized leader in health care delivery and electronic health care records, we are committed to leading the federal government in information security. Along that line, in an October 19, 2005 memorandum, Secretary Nicholson ordered the reorganization of VA's IT operations. In February 2006, the Secretary strongly advised senior agency officials at a senior management retreat that VA's IT reorganization was his top priority. In that regard, on April 30th of this year, over 4,000 employees were detailed to the Office of Information and Technology as part of this implementation plan. As of the end of the current fiscal year, those employees will permanently be transferred to the Office of Information Technology. This has placed all IT operations and maintenance personnel under the supervisory control of the CIO. Another major development was announced yesterday by the Secretary, that VA is committed to providing 1 year of free credit monitoring to individuals whose sensitive personal information, their names and Social Security numbers, may have been stolen as a result of this incident. Providing free credit monitoring will help safeguard those who may be affected and will provide them with the peace of mind they deserve. This week, VA will solicit bids from qualified companies to provide a comprehensive credit monitoring solution. VA will ask these companies to provide expedited proposals and be prepared to implement them rapidly once they are under contract. Once VA hires a credit monitoring company, the department will send a detailed letter to individuals whose sensitive personal information may have been included in the stolen data. This letter will explain credit monitoring and how those eligible can enroll or opt in for the services. The department expects to have the credit monitoring services in place and the letters mailed by mid-August. VA will also be soliciting bids to hire a company that provides data breach analysis, which will look for possible misuse of the stolen VA data. The analysis will help measure the risk of the data loss, identify suspicious misuse of identity information, and expedite full assistance to affected individuals. These efforts will augment the other aggressive steps VA has already implemented in response to the unfortunate incident. As previously announced, the Secretary has already directed a series of personnel changes in the affected office within the department. Secretary has also hired the former Maricopa County, Arizona prosecutor Richard Romley as a special advisor for information security. He ordered the expedited completion of cybersecurity awareness training and privacy awareness training for all VA employees, and also ordered an inventory of all positions requiring access to sensitive VA data. He also asked that every laptop undergo a security review. and that VA facilities across the country, every hospital, CBOC, community outpatient clinic, regional office, national cemetery field office, and VA central office here in Washington observe a Security Awareness Week beginning next Monday. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify, and I will be glad to answer any questions from the committee.
All right. First, I have you been present during the discussions on formulating this policy to provide the free credit monitoring? Were you present at these discussions?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What does free credit monitoring mean?
Well, it will be defined by the bids that are received in response to the RFP that's gone out. Credit monitoring is a package of services that are offered by, for the most part, the three major credit bureaus and possibly others. And they have different levels of this service that you can actually purchase from them. The RFP will be requesting a very robust package to cover the veterans, and it will be determined by actually what the bids are in response to the solicitation.
You got my attention in your testimony when you talked about a comprehensive approach. My sensing from my colleagues is that's where our greatest interest is. And so let me go back to my earlier comments when I heard about the O-credit monitoring. It has to be about more than just that. And that's also our testimony from the first panel. So now we say, okay, we're going to provide the credit monitoring. You say we're going to do bids to do a comprehensive approach, and then we're also going we're going to do a second project. You've got two proposals that are going to be going out there. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. Tell me a little bit more about your first proposal for a comprehensive approach. Is that sort of what the gentleman was talking about from analytics, or what also what Intellius does out there in the private sector?
Sir, the comprehensive approach would be the entire, would be everything. In other words, both solicitations that go out, which would include a robust credit monitoring package, and it would include a company to come in and do the data breach analysis.
Okay. But on the on a comprehensive approach, are we also saying that you would, you are considering the purchase of an insurance-based product?
Yes, sir, because that normally comes with your normal commercial credit monitoring package. If you were to go to any of the big three credit bureaus, that would be included in a package.
Mr. McClain, that's a big deal. I think that's a big deal. Because Congress out here just yesterday, the Judiciary Committee immediately goes out there and does the claims adjudication process. And when I brought that up, I talked to the Secretary about that. And he's like, whoa, Steve, I know what you're trying to do. Let's see what's available in the commercial market. Even if we were to do that, do we want to keep it in-house? Would we keep it under you? Would you create a separate agency to do that? You don't want it to be organic, limited in scope, limited in time. A lot of things to think and consider about. But you can notice how heightened members are about the issue that the Judiciary Committee would run out. So I would welcome the VA to explain this a little bit further as you're formulating this. I think that the VA is saying that we are interested in providing that financial assurance through an insurance-based product while we do this will make veterans feel a little better. Would you agree?
Yes, sir, and we'll be glad to. I'm certainly not the expert in the credit monitoring packages or the insurance, but we'll be glad to provide the committee with a more detailed briefing as to exactly what that entails.
All right. Here's what is happening, is that not only are you learning the VA more about this, so are we, and that we want to work with you on how you develop your comprehensive approach, as opposed to us, you know, either that or we dictate something, and we don't want to have to do that. I mean, we can set parameters, but but you're also going to be coming here and asking us to pay for it. Okay? With that, I yield to Mr. Filner.
Mr. McLean, I think you ought to be ashamed of the testimony you just gave us. You sat through, it was an hour and a half of testimony detailing some very grave problems in the culture of the VA. We also heard some very technical and very specific suggestions on what we might do, including the weaknesses of just credit monitoring. And you read the same thing that you walked in with, as if you didn't hear anything, nothing's wrong, the secretary's taking action, you're taking action, everything is fine. Nothing went wrong. You said personnel actions. You got the lowest guy on administrative leave, and it's not clear he violated any policy anyway, and his superior resigned. We just heard of extensive management failures of VA. You don't address one thing. It didn't happen. Somebody didn't hear that other thing. I mean, you're testifying about a completely different world that exists from what we heard. I think we're accepting here the first world, because we've had this. You have the biggest breach of security of identities in the history of this country, and the secretary is doing this and doing that. I mean, you haven't come to grips with the issue. I mean, your testimony shows the very reason why we have a problem. You don't recognize anything. You don't admit anything. You don't acknowledge anything. You don't want to change anything. You're going to have, you'll see what the bidders say is what an RFP, what a package will be. You don't have any of your own thoughts on that. I mean, this is disgraceful. This is disgraceful. Given the testimony we've had of Dr. Spafford and Mr. Brody and Mr. Cook, why shouldn't you and everybody above you in the chain be held responsible for the data loss? It was your memos that said there couldn't be any centralization. It was your memos that contradicted the authority of FSMA. It was your memos that said the secretary is not going to do this. Why shouldn't you not be fired for this this incredible breach?
Mr. Filner, first of all, I think that VA has taken this very seriously. I mean, this is...
The first step is to acknowledge a problem. Read your statement again and show me where you acknowledge that there were some errors in the management of your agency. Show me where. I just read your whole testimony. Not one word to show that you understand the severity of the problem. You know, they say the first step in understanding addiction to something is, you know, you have to get rid of denial. You're still in denial.
Denial that there's a...
That there's something through the culture of the VA management system that caused this.
I believe that the secretary has testified on more than one occasion in front of this committee and others saying that there was a problem, and it's made him mad as hell.
I can see everybody's mad as hell sitting there. When did you hear about the data, the breach, after May 3rd? When did you hear about it?
May 16th.
You don't think that's a problem in your system? That it took you 2 weeks to hear something?
I believe it is.
So what are you doing about it?
We're
you're asking for an RFP, and you're doing something. You don't have to say. You're not doing one thing about the management, as far as I can tell.
Oh, I think that...
Tell me. What are you doing?
We're doing a complete review of information security in every single office in the VA. From the lessons learned from that, and this is being chaired by the Deputy Secretary, from the lessons learned, we're going to move forward with implementing changes so that there is a uniform information security policy throughout the...
What was the lessons you have learned?
Sir?
You said we're going to implement the lessons learned. What lessons have you learned?
That we need to pay more attention to information security, that we have... people out there that do not realize that what they have is a veteran's personal data in their hands or on their laptop when they are...
Don't talk about other people. What have you learned? I want to know what you have learned. Do you question what you did in those other memos in 03 and 04 when you said, you know, you gave basically the legal rationale for not doing anything? Would you retract those or would you redo them? Tell me what you have learned.
Mr. Filner, I would not retract those, I think.
Okay, you're the problem.
Correct.
You are the problem, and until we admit that, it's not going
to
change.
I am going to need to recess the committee. We have 6.5 minutes left. We have three votes. So after these three votes, we'll return. Thank you. The committee stands in recess. PA committee will come back to order. And I yield to the gentleman, Mr. Filner, so he may resume his line of questioning. Mr. Filner, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for waiting for us, Mr. McLean. I guess the summary of what I was trying to say before was that we had a whole series of panelists who agreed on several things, and all my colleagues seem to agree also. The issue of authority and resources for the chief information officer or chief information security officer. And you made no comment on it. Your memos on this issue, where you debate the meaning of the word ensure, reminds me of the president who was trying to debate the meaning of is. I mean, when I read this thing, I mean, you're looking for any reason not to give the CSIO the CISO the authority he needs. And I asked you if you would retract those. You said no. But that's so. Do you believe that we have to pass additional legislation to give the CISO authority in your department? Although you say here too, the secretary can do it on his own. Have you made any steps in changing that authority in the VA? You said you're doing all these wonderful things. But everybody agreed that was the main thing.
Well, Mr. Filner, regarding the opinions, I do believe the opinions state the state of the law at the time that those opinions were written. In other words, the issues would come in or questions would come in, and indeed in the case of the April 7th, 2004 opinion, we had three different offices ask us to opine on the particular issue of FISMA.
Do you think that the CISO ought to have the authority that the three panelists all agreed on? You're going to go through the same crap, so I don't want to listen to it again. But do you believe that they should have the authority for good cybersecurity?
Well, I don't.
You personally, what do you think? Why don't you ask us for legislation that would give you, so you can opine on these things in a way that would give the CISO authority? You're hiding behind all these words and these opinions and everything. Do you think, you're the general counsel, do you think the CISO ought to have the authority to enforce the decisions that he makes?
I think that if the CIO had additional authority, it would probably make his particular job easier. Is that a good idea? That's really a policy discussion and not a legal discussion.
Other agencies have interpreted the same law as giving their CISOs that authority, right?
I'm not aware of that, sir.
Have you asked other agencies? You opined, but did you consult other general counsels to see what they said?
No, we didn't.
Seemed to me that'd be a good thing to do. It looks to me that you all decided he shouldn't have it, and you found a way to quibble with the word ensure, and then you figured out a way. And yet, everybody agrees that that's the wrong situation. And when Principi tried to implement it, he got resisted from everybody. That's what I meant. So I said, you're the problem. You're the problem. I mean, you don't even believe that he should have the authority, do you? The way you said it. It's a policy issue. I'm asking you what you think. We just had the biggest breach in the history of the government, and you're still quibbling about what the word ensure means. Should that person have the authority to enforce cybersecurity rules?
Yes, in some form he should.
Well, thank you. Now, would you recommend to us, please, by tomorrow,
what you would need when you opine that he could actually have that authority? I mean, you're the counsel. Give us some advice on that. Give us the language that you would opine that it would be that we would have it.
I'd be glad to discuss it with your staff, Congressman Filner.
Call me. I don't. My staff doesn't. You don't talk to my staff. But you're saying it would be a good thing. So make a recommendation that would make it happen, since you don't think it can happen under the existing legislation.
Well, I didn't say it couldn't happen under the existing legislation. In fact, both of the opinions refer to the fact that there can be a delegation of authority.
So why hasn't there been?
There has been, to a certain degree, in the reorganization that is already underway.
Has there been any change since May 3rd?
No, I don't believe
of this year, since the security breach?
I don't believe so.
Well, come on. I mean, that's why I say, and you know, and you guys get mad, you're not doing anything. I mean, you are not focusing on the major problems. You're just there to continue. So, Mr. Chairman, as I said, this is very frustrating. You've been on this for several years. I have to admit that I didn't pay the attention to you I should have, and I don't think the Congress did. And we have now the opportunity to do what you want to do, and I think we're all going to be behind you. This is not an issue coming from the lone action of one employee. That's what you guys keep stressing, because you think he's going to be terminated. We heard that enforcement guidance for cybersecurity is at best confusing. Some say it doesn't exist. We know that Mr. Brody and others tried to get that authority. It didn't happen. And it all comes back to the policies and the management who makes those policies. And that nobody seems to be accepting that responsibility, Mr. McLean, not the secretary, not the deputy, not you. And I can't understand what type of leaders would fail to do their jobs and then try to put the blame on everybody else. When we didn't secure an Iraqi ammo dump, the DOD blamed the troops. When FEMA failed to execute a disaster plan, they blamed the weather. Now, after years of failing to implement a clear and meaningful policy, you blame an employee for breaking some unidentified policy. Mr. Chairman, I hope that, again, that you continue what you started. You have backing from all of us, and I think the American people, and we should not tolerate these policies or the failed leadership that allows them to continue. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I have a further line of questioning, Mr. Michaud, but let me make this statement. I'll yield to the gentleman. If you have additional questions, do you? Okay. Okay, all right. Prior to the break, I had mentioned to the colleagues what the Judiciary Committee had done yesterday with regards to setting up a separate agency to deal with claims adjudication as an administrative remedy for pathway to the tort claims, Federal Tort Claims Act. And I have asked the majority leader to hold that at the moment. It really is just a great example of the heightened awareness, Mr. McLean, that members of Congress have, to, quote, do something. But that can also get you in trouble. And so I am very sincere in sharing with you, number one, what I had done with the majority leader. Number two, my conversation that I just had about 10 minutes ago with Chairman Walsh. I know that the Secretary will be before his committee on Tuesday. I plan on attending. And then I'll see the Secretary again on Thursday. But over this time period of the next 10 days, we want to work with you. And I took from your testimony an inference. And it's okay. And the inference is that we're outside our lane with how do we deal with this. We've never had to deal with this before. So when you say to the committee that we're going to do an RFP and we're interested in see what they're going to bring us, usually that's still kind of backwards. We formulate these kind of things and let the private sector know what we want. And it's okay. I'm not going to be critical of you because we're interviewing, just like you're interviewing, trying to figure out how do we best deal with this because of its scope, and also to pay, how do we pay for it? I'm not a contract lawyer. I got to yield to you. And
I'm not either, sir.
All right. So that's why I'm not going to. I'm not going after you on that.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I'm concerned.
I'm sorry.
I just want to let you know I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about what the Judiciary Committee did. So what I'm saying to you, please convey to the Secretary what the Judiciary Committee just did. I'm going to hold that as much as I can, okay, with my relationship with the majority there, to hold that. Let's craft a product that not only can we begin to monitor, but we can also place the veteran in the assurance that that they're not going to have an out-of-pocket loss. They're going to have a disruption of their, potentially a disruption of their life. This is going to be uncomfortable, but if we're able to create a product, and there's some out there that can give them up to $25,000 insurance with regard to the loss, and we make that part of a package, I think that's exactly where the Secretary was in his conversation with me. Not by number, we didn't discuss numbers, but please, I yield to the gentleman.
Thank you, sir. I was just saying that I know that they're working very hard on the statement of work, which will be with the RFP, and I'm sure that it will define exactly what we're looking for from the three companies or even more.
Well, whoever the they is, will the they communicate with our staff and, more important, just as important, communicate with the appropriators?
Yes.
Last thing you want to have happen is put together something that you think is best that has not been communicated with the appropriators, and you just turn to them and say, pay for it.
No, I understand.
You know, my gosh, you're going to end up just with what they did with Denver, and they zeroed out something because there wasn't the best of communications. Right. Mr. Michaud?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McLean, the VA Directive 6504, dated on June 7th of this year, stated that, and I quote, the VA employees are permitted to transport, transmit, access, and use VA data outside VA facilities only when such activity has been specifically approved by the employer's supervisor and when appropriate security measures are taken to ensure VA information and services are not compromised, end of quote. How does this policy, different than what was done prior to the May 3rd of this year?
Congressman Michaud, I'm going to have to not get into that area because of the three pending class action lawsuits that the actual policies and procedures that were in place at the time are at issue in each one of those lawsuits. And on advice of our attorney, the Department of Justice, I can't comment on that.
Do you believe that the data involved in the May 3rd incident constitute a national security database or a non-national security?
I have not looked into that nor rendered any opinion on that particular issue.
Have you been asked to render an opinion?
I have not.
So no one at VA is looking at this issue?
Well, I know that it has come up in the hearings and someone's looking at it, but my office has not been asked to render an opinion on it.
Okay, and you have no idea who's looking at it in the VA? Because it has come up in previous hearings.
I believe the Office of Information Technology is looking into it right now.
Okay. In your memorandum of April 7th of 2004 states that FSMA does not require the Secretary to provide the CIO with enforcement powers to the extent that he chooses to do so. However, he may delegate more authority to the CIO than is provided for by FSMA. A couple of questions is, what specific authority has the Secretary delegated prior to May 3rd of 2006, and has the Secretary delegated any additional authority since that date, and if so, to which officers?
I don't believe that there was any delegation beyond the actual mandates of FSMA and the Clinger-Cohen Act and also the Paperwork Reduction Act, kind of the three acts that really control what the CIO does. There has been a lot of discussion on what is required at this point, and that's exactly what I was talking about before, is we're currently doing a complete inventory of all information security practices in every office in the VA. And based upon that inventory and that list of best practices and recommendations, I'm sure that there will be further action taken.
So you agree that the Secretary can delegate to the CIO the authority that he needs to make sure that this information security issues are upheld?
I believe that, yes, I believe that there is sufficient authority that resides with the Secretary that could be delegated down. Now, the one caveat that I want to put on it is that there was some discussion, and in particular, Mr. Brody made a statement that he was frustrated that there was pushback from HR, I guess, when relating to actual sanctions or penalties against government employees. And, of course, that is a problem. When I say a problem from an enforcement point of view, every employee is protected by a lot of Title V rules and regulations in the government. And the question would be, could the CIO impose a penalty or sanction or discipline on, say, a VHA employee doesn't belong to the CIO, a VHA employee in the state of Washington, for example. That would raise tremendous questions under Title V, Title 38, those issues would require legislation along some lines in order to accomplish the complete ability to impose sanctions.
Even if the Secretary gives them that authority?
The Secretary may not have that authority because of the laws that are in place. And that's why I made it a caveat.
Okay. And does the Secretary know that he has the authority to delegate a lot more than what has been delegated? Has anyone told the Secretary he has that authority?
Yes.
So he is aware of it?
Yes, he is.
Okay. And has he made any overtures to you that he is looking in that direction to give all the authority that he can to the CIO?
There have been quite a few discussions, as you can imagine, recently on that issue. And I'm not going to speak for the Secretary, but I believe that there may be action forthcoming.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Thank you. Ms. Forsyth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was a little confused by some of the responses, and I know I was a little late getting back in here, but let me just walk through that line of questioning of Mr. Michoud's once again. Your interpretation is that the Secretary has the authority to delegate certain responsibilities to the CIO.
Yes.
And that would include enforcement authorities?
Yes, certain enforcement authorities.
Certain enforcement authorities. No, but appreciate that. I think that's
that's the next question.
or let's say which ones would not be?
What I had just responded in the actual taking disciplinary action against an employee that is not within his department. In other words, let me, if I can, analogize this a little bit. Under Title V rules of a federal civil service, the appropriate person to propose discipline is the employee supervisor. And so that system is used every day, still in place, and indeed that could indeed be used today in order to impose discipline on an employee that does not follow published rules and regulations.
So separate from disciplinary actions, the Secretary would have the authority to delegate any other enforcement necessary to ensure compliance by the agency with information security requirements?
I believe so. I mean, there's quite a few things that the CIO could do. I mean, under FISMA, and the CIO has the authority in order to set all of the standards that for access, for classification, for personnel, those sorts of things, in order to get onto the CIO equipment, the computer equipment, and how to use it and what to do with it. He can, and if you're talking about enforcement, he can prevent someone from getting on, prevent someone from bringing a piece of equipment on.
From implementing the requirements?
Yes, yes.
Are you aware in, you know, your memos have been the focus of a lot of the questions and even some of the discussion in prior hearings. Are you aware of any similar conclusions that you drew regarding the CIO's enforcement purview of any other general counsel and any other federal agencies reviewing the same types of questions that would come up about enforcement authorities with the CIO?
That question was asked, and the answer is no. I'm not aware of any others.
Let me ask just a couple questions with regard to implementation of the March 2004 Principi Memorandum. Your written testimony states that it might be helpful to briefly state what the Department has done to implement Secretary Principi's 2004 memorandum. You then state that on April 30th, 2006, approximately 4,000 FTE were temporarily detailed to the Office of Information and Technology. Was that step taken to effectuate the March 2004 memorandum, which calls on then-CIO Robert McFarland to devise a department-wide cybersecurity program under FISMA, or was that a step taken to meet other department requirements or responsibilities, such as the creation of a separate information technology account in last year's VA appropriations bill?
I think it was a step in direct line with the Secretary's October 2005 decision to order an IT reorganization in the department.
And do you believe that the items you list in your testimonies addressing the March 2004 memorandum are sufficient actions to have taken in response to that memorandum in the more than 2 years since it was released?
I think that it is certainly a large step in the right direction. Are there other things that need to be done? Yes, and certainly the department acknowledges that there's more to be done in order to effectuate not only this memorandum but the IT reorganization.
Do you have any thoughts on any of the recommendations Mr. Brody made in his written testimony that was submitted, and most of which I think he also restated in his oral testimony today?
No, I have no comment.
Would you if you had more time to consider them?
Perhaps.
I would then request from the chairman that perhaps you could submit just any thoughts on those recommendations that he submitted to the committee from your experience in the last number of years here as general counsel on those recommendations.
All right, certainly.
Thank you. I'd yield back.
Because point of order, we have a counsel here. What's the definition of contempt of Congress? I mean, those last two answers were in contempt of Congress, Mr. Counsel. They may not meet any legal thing. We sat here for 2 hours, asked questions. He made recommendations. You have no comment. Perhaps you'll have something to say. That's just irresponsible. That's contempt of Congress.
All right, Mr. McClain, I have a series of questions, and it's going to follow the same line, some issues Mr. Filner brought up, in particular Mr. Michaud and Ms. Herseth. I think I just got it for the first time. I saw you look up. My lisp, I worked through it.
Now try Snyder.
One at a time. You are Senate confirmed, correct?
Yes, I am.
And your title is an assistant secretary, right?
No, my title is general counsel.
General counsel, but your equivalent rank is assistant secretary.
That's correct.
Are you a senior government official?
depending on your...
Are you a senior government official?
I believe I would. The position would be considered a senior government official. Yes, sir.
Assistant Secretary. How about, what's the next level down? Assistant? Are they deputies?
Deputy assistant
secretaries? Are they Senate confirmed?
No.
So would you say that if you're Senate confirmed, then you would be a senior government official?
Probably. Yes, sir.
Trying to figure this out. How do you see your role as general counsel? Are you the VA's chief legal officer?
Yes.
Okay. And how do you see your role?
My role is the final legal word in the department on legal issues that are brought to our attention. In interpreting laws and in interpreting regulations. I am the counsel to the department and for the most part provide counsel to the secretary, the deputy, and senior leadership.
Deputy secretary, so when you say to the department, access to you is going to come from the secretary, the deputy, and the three undersecretaries?
When you say access to me.
Yeah, they come right, they pick up the phone and you answer.
Yes, sir. I will.
Okay. At what point does that, I'm trying to understand, I don't know the culture, so I'm just trying to understand. At what point do you not pick up the phone? In other words, is that at what level? Is that at a, I don't know.
Everything
has a hierarchy.
For me in particular, I have an open door policy, so I pretty much answer almost everyone's telephone calls or
emails.
Yeah,
but you've got 400 lawyers out there.
Yes, we do.
You know, you're responsible for them all.
That's right. We have about 270 in the field and the others here in Washington.
How long have you been the general counsel?
Since April of 2001.
Who's your client?
The department.
Who is the department?
Everyone in VA.
When, what level of, I'm trying to figure out meetings for which general counsel is required to attend. They are what? What meetings are you required to attend?
Pretty much any meeting that is scheduled or called for by the secretary and deputy secretary, any boards or other type of advisory committees that I'm on, and can be invited to other meetings in the department that are scheduled by the undersecretaries or an assistant secretary.
Are there lawyers from your team that also would work for the undersecretaries? Are there any
Not directly.
Not directly. Okay. So the way you just said that, you like having line authority over your lawyers?
Yes.
Really? I bet the CIO does too.
Probably does.
Yeah.
Not over my lawyers, but over his employees.
So who in your legal department has responsibility for cybersecurity?
We have a, I believe it's a GS-15, who is responsible for our cybersecurity primarily, but ultimately I would be responsible for cybersecurity.
Given your reaction to my question, so do you personally and professionally have concerns that the CIO could have enforcement authority over one of your employees?
No, I don't. See, what when you say, as it turns out, the initial reorganization that I think was ordered back in 2002 when Admiral Gauss was the CIO, turned out that there were a small number that of employees that were actually transferred to the Office of Information Technology, and my information technology employees were transferred at that time. So we're actually functioning under this program where they're doing work for us, but they actually belong to the CIO.
So how does it work that if you have a vulnerability in your legal department, and the CIO of whom has only authority over compliance, he can only ensure compliance, has no authority to enforce anything, he would then have to alert you that there is a vulnerability and that you then have the authority to cure. Is that how it was supposed to work?
Yes.
Okay. So when the FISMA report says that there are these 16 vulnerabilities and that the VA receives an F, fails, that then means that the three undersecretaries receive the grade of F. Would it not?
I imagine so, yes. The whole department received a grade of F.
Uh-huh. So given the lines of authority as to who is actually responsible for enforcement, it's hard for me to imagine, as the first panel described, that when you grant responsibility without authority, you're setting the position for someone to be a scapegoat. I don't see how the CIO could be a scapegoat if they had no authority to enforce. Therefore, there is no scapegoat. There's individuals who are responsible, and the individuals of whom are responsible also have the authority. That's what's hard for me in all of this. And it's hard for me when I read your opinions. That's why I call it the heterodox, because it's so incongruent of what we do in our society. Because we have a leadership hierarchy in our society that someone is responsible, has the authority, and therefore can be held accountable. When I take something out of that, it becomes incongruent, and it defies logic, and it makes it hard for us then to operate a system, actually even to perfect change. So I have some more series of questions for you. VA's, let me go back to when I mentioned the F. As the VA's chief legal officer, you are also, are you not, responsible to ensure that the VA is compliant with existing law? FISMA.
I'm responsible for interpreting those laws and how they apply to our business in the VA.
Okay.
Sir.
All right. So when the FISMA report shows 16 vulnerabilities and that the department has now received a failing grade, I would say that they're not in compliance with an existing statute. When it comes to you as the lawyer, do you worry about that or not worry about that?
Well, I'm obviously concerned about it, and the question is it because there was inaction on the part of certain people? In other words, you would want to look at are we indeed violating a law or not fully implementing a law?
All right. If the VA receives a failing grade from their audit, how can that be following the law?
Well, if the law itself is not implemented within the department, you have the situation where the law is there, and it's not being followed.
Right. Well, that's what I had back in 1999 when I couldn't get the VA to create a CIO. You're right. We pass the laws, and we try to get the executive branch to implement, to execute. Does this issue of CIO authority affect the General Counsel's office in terms of control over General Counsel's IT assets?
No.
Okay. So your concerns are more on the personnel side then. So would that be correct?
You mean for for Office of General Counsel employees.
For the Office of General Counsel, yes.
My only concern is that I have a good IT network that I can rely on and utilize, and that my people in the field can rely on and utilize. And so, as I said, my employees that I had were transferred over to the CIO. And so we're currently operating pretty well right now under that criteria.
All right. These memos that members are discussing, in my mind, I have this visual of you conducting a brief with the three undersecretaries, the deputy and the secretary. I don't know. Did that ever happen? Or do you just send the memos and people just go about their business?
These particular memos, a memo of this nature would come into the office either as an email request or a written request for a general counsel opinion on how this particular law applies to this set of facts, whatever it might be. That's pretty much how these opinions were initiated, and the opinion would be worked by staff attorneys, and it would then come up the administrative chain to my office, and the opinion then would be reviewed and signed and sent back to whoever the addressee is on the memo. In other words, the requesting office. I believe one of them was the CIO or the Assistant Secretary for Information Technology and the Assistant Secretary for Policy and Planning.
When you have a dispute between a matter of interpretation of a law or regulation between two undersecretaries, who's your client?
Is the department. I simply will
I don't know what that means. The two undersecretaries are part of the department. The two undersecretaries disagree on something. How about when the CIO disagrees with the three undersecretaries, who is the department?
Well, they all are. And I don't take sides on it. The question would come to me, we have a dispute. I think the law should be applied this way. Someone else thinks the law should be applied that way. Please give us your opinion. And that's what we would do. It may be in the middle somewhere. It may not be exactly either person's position.
All right, use the word role. What is your role and responsibility? What is the role and responsibility of the Secretary of the VA for information security under FISMA?
He's ultimately responsible for ensuring that there is a system in place that ensures the security and accountability of personal information.
Okay. And was the Secretary aware of his statutory role and responsibility?
Sir, I'm not sure. You'll have to ask the Secretary.
At any time, were you asked to brief the Secretary with regard to his role and responsibility in this area?
No, sir.
Okay. All right, let me power through this. Hang in here with me, all right? The General Counsel Memo of August 1 of 2003 on information security to the CIO holds that, quote, FISMA requires the CIO to develop and implement an agency-wide security program to achieve the purposes of FISMA, end quote. Now, that sounds pretty good. But then on February 19th of 2004 memo, what that meant to your office was explained further. The memo suggests that enforcement language in draft directive 6500 be removed that would allow the CIO to hold individuals accountable to the CIO for noncompliance and that would establish mandatory penalties. In addition, the memo recommended that language empowering the CIO to mandate budgetary commitments of administrations be removed because, quote, we are not aware of statutory authority. Basically, this leaves the CIO with responsibility but no real authority to make anything happen. That's what we've been discussing here today. So Directive 6500 could have been written, could it not, to have empowered the CIO, since you then state that the Secretary could have delegated that authority. Because what you have is, first you go, there is no statutory authority, and the Secretary has the authority. Where was the next step of legal counsel back to the Secretary that says, Mr. Secretary, you can delegate it if you want, but there was no affirmative action was ever taken?
Well, I understand, Mr. Chairman, where you're going. I think the issue that I would ask is, given our opinion and given the February 19th, 2004 memorandum, that there's no statutory authority for certain issues, and most of the issues were clustered under security clearance and suitability policies, security matters beyond that of the information and information security, and also personnel matters, human relations and labor management issues. In the memo, and I'm talking in that memo, subparagraphs, paragraph 2A1, and then 2A2, B, C, and D, essentially, in that particular memo. And what we're saying is entirely consistent with all of the opinions read together, is that the current state of the law does not give the CIO these particular powers or authorities. That's what the opinions are. It's a point in time on the date that they were issued. What is the state of the law as applied to the set of facts that we were asked to analyze?
Is it a curious thing that this March 16, 2004 memo has no subject line? The Secretary's memo, March 16, 2004, has no subject line. Not a curious thing? I'm just being...
I note that it does not. That's.
But you're saying, Steve, your attention to detail is too great.
Well, no.
It's not a curious thing. I shouldn't make anything of it.
Okay.
Doesn't mean anything.
No, sir.
All right. Let me go to what you had just stated. I got FISMA right here. Okay. And you're right. Two lawyers can read something that can totally, we can disagree. We can agree to disagree. But I read this thing differently than how you read it. Now, I'm looking at Section 3544, Federal Agency Responsibilities. Now, you just made an interpretation that says that the CIO doesn't have this responsibility. It's not granted to him by FISMA. But when I read this, Section 3544A, the head of each agency shall, okay, do you have it right there in front of you?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay, so it says A shall be responsible for, and it lists A, B, and C. Okay. Number two, it says ensure that senior agency officials provide information security for information systems that support the operation assets under their control, including, goes down the whole list. Who are senior agency officials?
Pretty much what we had talked about previously, undersecretaries, assistant secretaries can be senior agency officials, and it may even go further down than that in relation to FISMA and information security.
When I read FISMA, if I wanted to, I could read this to interpret that only a senior agency official would be an undersecretary and exclude the CIO. Your testimony to me is that the general counsel and the CIO is the equivalent of a senior agency official. Now, if I go back and I say, okay, I accept your testimony here today that you're a senior agency official, the CIO is a senior agency official, the undersecretary is a senior agency official, and now I read this law, I don't understand how I can get the interpretation from your memo doing that. Sir. Now, if I want to parse what I read and say that a senior agency official does not apply to what? You and the CIO, then I could come up with that memo as it's been drafted.
I think the spirit of the opinion obviously is interpreting FSMA. But I think that what's important to realize and what I get out of this applying these sorts of requirements to senior agency officials is that there is a department-wide requirement, and especially imposed upon senior agency officials to ensure that that this system of protection for personal information is in place and operating. It's not giving it or requiring it of a single person or a single head in the department. It is literally spreading it out and saying, you're a senior agency official, you have this responsibility.
The section of FSMA that makes the secretary responsible for implementation of this statute, 3544, states that the head of each agency shall, and again, I'm going to say it, ensure that senior agency officials provide information security for information systems that support the operations and assets under their control. The under the secretary's March 24 memo, assuming that it had been implemented sooner than last October, wouldn't the CIO also fit under these provisions of FSMA? That's what I just asked. Because he would be a senior agency official under the authority of 4,000 agency employees. The reason I ask this question, Mr. McLean, is I have the sense that these memos essentially were efforts to box the CIO.
No, sir.
Well, that's what's happened by that legal interpretation. You disagree with that?
Yes, sir, I disagree with that. I don't disagree that the CIO perhaps wanted additional authority that was just simply not there in statute. But the opinion is the legal opinion as to what the law provides.
All right, why did it take until October 19th of 2005, over a year and a half, for the VA to take just the first step in acting on Secretary Principe's memo? A glacial pace.
Sir, I don't have an answer for that.
Mr. Chairman.
Did Mr. McFarland? Yes, ma'am.
Well, before you went too far down this, may I just follow up on a...
Yes.
If you just stated that the CIO perhaps wanted more authority than your interpretation of the statute allowed, right?
Yes.
But not too long ago, in response to some of the other questions, does your interpretation of the statute, however, where does the enforcement authority or the authority that the CIO is seeking resides in the secretary? Because getting back to this whole issue of what authorities the secretary could have delegated, I'm still trying to figure out, and I think the chairman was raising this at the beginning of his second line of his line of questioning when he began again. Tell me the distinction between your interpretation of the statute and the authorities granted to the CIO versus authorities that the secretary has that could be delegated. Is there a distinction?
Yes.
And if there's, okay, so I'm going to let you explain the distinction and then re-ask the question that I believe the chairman did, which is, at what point could you have or did you communicate with the secretary about the possibility of delegating some of the authority that the CIO is seeking that the secretary may have had to delegate, separate from an interpretation of the statute that didn't give, in your opinion, the authorities the CIO is seeking?
Let me give you one example of some additional authorities that reside in the secretary that could have been delegated if the, at the Secretary's discretion, no requirement. First of all, FSMA requires the CIO to have certain responsibilities and duties and such. The Secretary could delegate further, and if I'll go back to the August 2003 opinion, which was essentially an opinion on who has authority over national versus non-national type of files, and also physical security versus of actual paper, that sort of thing. The opinion was that as the law currently stood, the that authority over the national type of data, if there was any in VA, and physical security resided in the Office of Law Enforcement within the department. Had the Secretary desired to make a change, he could have delegated that authority to the CIO. So there was already something in place.
I'll yield back.
I am, you know, I was really concerned when Bob McFarland left, and you are also quite aware, being on the inside, that you've had three undersecretaries that were pretty strong in their opinions. You were also equally strong in an opinion. The secretary had delegated to the deputy secretary to work this one, work this issue, and Mr. McFarland was pretty stressed because he felt that he was not getting a concurrence with his policies. So let me ask about the Directive 6500. Is Directive 6500, is it still in a development or a concurrence process?
I believe that 6500 is in our EDMS system, electronic data management system, document management system, still within the Office of Information Technology for internal concurrence within that office.
Under your federated approach, I know you don't like the word box. All right, let me rephrase this. Under your federated model, are your present, your interpretations that the CIO does not have these lines of authority to enforce, is that what's going to happen in your federated model? You're going to take that present opinion that you've held for the last several years and apply that to the federated model?
Well, I think that several things have changed. One is that this particular issue that we were wrestling with talked about ISOs, and in particular the March 2004 memo from Secretary Principi, I believe was a reaction, as Mr. Brody said, to the blaster worm situation where the CIO didn't have control, any sort of supervisory control over ISOs out in the field, and there were over 400 of them. As of April 30th of this year, with the detail of personnel into the Office of Information Technology, that situation no longer exists. The CIO has direct supervisory authority over the ISOs plus the other other IT backbone or maintenance type of people, even in the field.
But if I'm an undersecretary at the VA, and the CIO is giving me directives on compliant, where I'm non-compliant in a particular area, and I ignore him, what's the CIO's recourse legally?
Legally, I'm not sure he has one. Administratively, he should bring this directly to the deputy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's got no authority. How about if I make the CIO, the committee here decides to follow our instincts of a couple years ago and make the CIO the equivalency of an undersecretary. Still, does it matter?
In other words, would it change our interpretation of FSMA?
No, we're going to change FSMA. We're not going to let this stuff happen anymore. We're going to come up with our recommendations to change so that it's not subject to interpretation.
Right.
But if we go in and we make the CIO an undersecretary equivalent and give him lines of authority and the ability to enforce, actually, let's go to the ability to enforce. Mm-hmm. Would you say that that undersecretary, the CIO, then would not have the ability to enforce anything on the, within the jurisdictions of the other three undersecretaries?
No. If Congress passed the law along the lines that you just outlined, then the law would provide the authority.
But unless we do that, your position is it's not there. It rests with the Secretary. The Secretary could grant that authority, could he not? If you can grant, you can also remove.
In
the Secretary
most cases,
could remove certain authorities from the other three undersecretaries, could he not?
Yes, he could.
Aha! Was that ever recommended to the secretary or the deputy, that you could remove certain authorities? You can grant authority to the CIO, but never?
I'm not aware.
Aware of it? Mm-hmm. Well, I could see in disciplinary actions a challenge between granting authority or powers to someone who is not of an equal, you know, if they're under the undersecretary.
Yeah, that's what we're going to have to do, Mr. Filner.
Just a quick question, if I can. No. Does the VA have a policy of executive bonuses and bonuses to the senior staff?
Not to political appointees, but to senior executive service.
Okay, so you don't get a bonus?
No.
So none of the political appointees do?
That's right.
And what's the first level that may get one?
Who are SES.
And were those bonuses given last year?
You
don't know.
I imagine they were, yes, but I have no personal knowledge of it.
And when FSMA audit gave the department an F, did you take that in any way personally or share in that responsibility?
As to the department getting an F, I think the entire department has to share in that.
Yeah, but personally, nothing happened to any person as a result. Nobody got pay cuts or reprimands or censure or anything.
Sir, I don't know. I would not know.
But you didn't
be involved in that.
But you didn't.
I did not.
Yeah, I mean, there's simply no accountability here.
I made a note here, Mr. Filner, when we come back and discuss how to put together this legislation, Mr. Michaud, that we should even consider writing in our bill. We can seek compliance and say that there shall be no bonuses until the department is compliant with FSMA. If you got an F and we're given bonuses, we shouldn't be doing that. I mean, we can put it on a sliding scale, get them to a B. You know, I haven't been beyond giving my kids money for a good grade. All right, I want to thank you to my colleagues for being here, and let me just say in conclusion, Mr. McClain, I know you're here. You're here to also defend your legal department and the individuals who wrote these legal opinions. I'm stressed by them. I'm stressed by them because I think that they were a contributing factor, and we ended up with a legal opinion that I'm going to say it for the umpteenth time, that is a heterodox opinion, and it was a contributing factor in the face of 16 unmitigated deficiencies, and something has to change, and we want to work with you. Please let the Secretary know with regard to the issue that I brought up earlier on when we were asking for that proposal, that it also include insurance. Please let them know that we're going to work cooperatively here in a bipartisan fashion to make sure that we hold the judiciary product until we can let them know that we're going to work in a positive manner. Okay. Mr. Show.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one last question, Mr. McLean. Being legal counsel to the department and with my experience in the Maine legislature, where the Attorney General's offices are legal counsel to state departments, you can take different opinions or different stance in different areas. Have you at any time, when we have been dealing with this whole issue of the CIO, given the verbal legal advice to the agency that this is the way you saw the law, but you were directed or asked by a senior official, so, well, I want to do this, can you justify this as well?
No.
Have you ever taken, no?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. All members will have 5 legislative business days to submit opening any statement that they may like. At this point, the hearing is now concluded. Thank you.